and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to the show tonight. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Tonight I have a very special guest, Dr. Henry Stapp, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Mind-Light Universe, Why the World Must Be Fundamentally Mind-Like and Not Matter-Like. Hello, Dr. Stapp, how are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you for being with us tonight. Before we get started, could you just tell my listeners a little bit about you? And please tell me if, I know I have a southern drawl, so please tell me if I give you a problem, okay? But tell us about you, what you do, where people can find you, and what you do in your 8-to-5 job.
Well, I'm a quantum physicist. I work at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California. And I originally did a lot of ordinary analysis of experiments being done here at the laboratory, but my interest has shifted over the years to, to the fundamental problems of how we human beings and our conscious lives fit into the to the world around us, the physical world, and this interest evolved from the fact that quantum mechanics, which is the present basic physical theory of nature, is very different from the earlier classical mechanics. The earlier classical mechanics left our consciousness, our mental aspects, completely out. It was a mechanical theory based on ideas about matter, and those theories were found early in the 20th century not to be compatible with experiments that were being done, and a new theory had to be created, which was quantum mechanics, and it was very different from the earlier theory in the sense that it brought our conscious minds, our experiences, into the dynamical development of the universe. And it was, in fact, based on human knowledge and upon the structure of our mental lives, whereas the earlier classical theory was based on matter and the properties of physical matter. And so this shift in the foundational ideas of quantum mechanics was baffling even to physicists, and many different ideas about how to understand it somehow were floating around, and I became more and more interested in these questions. So it's basically an idea of the nature of contemporary physics and its emphasis on human knowledge and human consciousness, and how that plays or can play or ought to play a very important role by understanding how it gives you a new understanding of how you as human beings fit into the world around us. And whereas the earlier theories gave no possibility for our mental aspects to enter into the flow of physical events, quantum mechanics is just the opposite. It basically allows our human intentions, mental intentions, to enter importantly into the dynamical workings of nature. And once you begin to understand how this works, I think it can play a very important role in allowing you to better relate to the world. So maybe that's kind of a long
I think it was wonderful. So for purposes of this interview, I think I told you I want to ask some definition questions. What is your definition of that word consciousness? For purposes of this interview, because I know it can have different meanings at different times, but what do you mean in this respect?
Well, consciousness, briefly, is about your inner life, what's called often your inner life. It's also the subject matter of psychology as opposed to physics. In our universities, we have psychology courses and we have physics courses, and they deal with different topics. Psychology deals with what William James called thoughts, ideas, and feelings. And so you can feel pain, you can have the sensation of sourness or joyousness or despondency. You can feel terrified, you can feel happy. And your experiences of the world, you have, you know, the experience of sourness, the experience of bitterness. So these are things that are normally called parts of your mental life. And these are opposed to, and they're only present somehow when you are awake and conscious. On the other hand, there are, according to normal people's ideas of the world, also things like tables and chairs that have a different sort of property. They're basically more enduring, and even when nobody's looking, you think the table is still there, and so it has a certain different enduring quality that the physical world has, enduring qualities that the mental world does not have. So consciousness, then again, is your thoughts, ideas, and feelings, as opposed to the physical world, which is thought to be composed of kind of hard rock-like little particles. And that idea, by the way, is the classical idea that the world is made up of little tiny bits of matter which occupy certain positions in space and time and move around in accordance with certain mathematical laws. That's the classical idea of what the world is like. And it leaves consciousness completely out of the dynamical equations and the dynamical laws of motion.
So would saying that there are two aspects of consciousness, maybe awareness being the psychology section, and would it be fair to say, just so we understand, that maybe the other aspect would be like the irreducible unit of an atom, so it would be everything that is? Does that make sense?
I'm not quite sure. Can you repeat that?
Oh, I'm sorry. So would it be fair to say that consciousness could be awareness, as
yes,
used in
true.
Psychology, or it could be the thing that's at the irreducible unit of an atom?
Well, the irreducible unit of an atom is basically its position and other properties, mathematical properties like its mass and its charge, if it's a charged particle. And so those are mathematical properties that you don't experience directly. We have an idea of what a particle is like, but the basic qualities of it are that it's an enduring quality that's localized in a certain place in the space-time universe. And our consciousness, you know, the feeling of sourness or the feeling of joyousness or the feeling of intention. I mean, one of the most important feelings is your intention to do something. And so it's a different sort of entity, an intention to do something, than just a rock that's sitting there with certain persisting properties.
Okay.
Nobody may be watching, nobody may be aware of.
So my next question, and we have to be careful in our time here since I'm asking defining things. For the purposes of this interview, please define your that your definition of the phrase free choice, because that's what you use in your book, is that the same as free will?
Yes, essentially, free will is a more generic term, but it consists of free choices. In other words, the typical idea of a free choice is that I can be sitting here and have the intention to raise my arm. And so what we our experience of life is I have an intention and my arm rises. And so I have the feeling that I could choose to make it rise or choose to make it write a letter S on the blackboard or a letter T on the blackboard, that I have the freedom to choose what sort of actions my body will take. And it's best understood in contrast to the ideas of classical mechanics. The ideas of classical mechanics say that the world is made up of these little objects or that move in accordance with mathematical laws, which have the property, according to the laws of classical mechanics, that the entire course of the physical universe, the motions of all the particles, are completely determined at the birth of the universe. And therefore, everything is fixed once for all before we were even born. Every motion that you will make was already determined beforehand by these physical laws. Before you were born, before your parents were born. And so that's the idea of determinism, which comes from classical mechanics. And free will is just the opposite of that. In other words, classical mechanics say that every motion that you're ever going to make was already determined and long, long ago, whereas free will is the opposite of that. It says that, no, there's a certain element of freedom that is the thing that you feel and are able and seem to be able to put into action. You feel that I have the freedom to do or not do various things. And so free will is a kind of a generic term. It means that you have free choices. You have the freedom to choose to do this or not do it.
Okay.
As you please.
Now, the next one is random choice. What is that?
Well, random choice is the idea that that some things, for example, when you throw a dice, it's such a complicated thing that it looks like you can say, well, it has a one chance in six of coming up number one, and it's all about chances and the probabilities that some particular thing will happen. And again.
Now I have a question. Where does the, and I don't want to get off in the weeds because we're already 15 after and we're just defining, but where does the chance come from?
Well, in ordinary classical mechanics, it doesn't say where it's coming from. And that, in my opinion, is a deficiency of the theory. According to orthodox quantum mechanical ideas, you just say that this thing that's called a random choice just appears. The way it works in quantum mechanics is that the observer poses a question, puts it to nature, and nature responds. It's a yes-no question, so nature responds yes or no. And there are certain, given the circumstances in which that question was asked, quantum mechanics allows you to determine the probability that the answer is yes. But it says that it comes from nowhere. It just says you must not ask, and there is no answer to the question, where it comes from. That is the principal place that I believe that we need to and can go beyond orthodox quantum mechanics and actually specify where it comes from. This is based on von Neumann's formulation of quantum mechanics. And in that formulation, interpreted in the way that he and I both interpret it, that choice comes from the mental realm. That there is a whole mental realm. In fact, according to von Neumann's terminology, he has something called the ego. And the ego is basically a mental being or a mental object. And from the depths of this mental world, on the basis of values and the reasons and things like this, more or less in accordance with how you feel, your choices are made. But there is a choice, and even nature's choice has reasons to be what it is. So random choice is the idea that these choices that occur in quantum mechanics and for which quantum mechanics gives the probabilities, 10%, 20% probability, according to orthodox quantum mechanics, these chances just come from nowhere. You're not supposed to ask where they come from. The bottom line is that the probability is 30% or something like that. Whereas I think you can make a better quantum theory by answering this question and allowing these choices to actually come from the mental life of the human being.
That's very interesting. So I was going to ask the question, is mental and emotional the same or different? But now I want to ask the question, and you can address it if you like. What is your definition of mind? Where does, and the different, and I'll go ahead and give you this. What's the difference? Do you distinguish between a big mind and a little mind?
Well, in my parlance, mind is essentially pretty much equivalent to consciousness. In other words, mind is the, is when you talk about your mind, you are talking about your conscious experiences. And it may be, it may include a little bit more in the sense that there are certain unconscious and subconscious and things that enter into human behavior that are very similar to consciousness but are not actually consciousness. And mind can sometimes be expanded to include things that are like conscious experiences but not quite conscious. And so, but basically mind is, in my terminology, essentially consciousness-like. I should say that some physicalists, which are people that do not wish to include mind as I describe it into the dynamics, define mind in a different way to be essentially brain. And that mind is brain is kind of their main thesis, whereas in my use of language, that's just the opposite of what is true. Mind is the other side of the coin. It's the conscious, essentially conscious aspect of the dynamic laws of...
So kind of like a brain would be a computer and mind would be that thing that it processes, perhaps? Something like that?
Well, and, certainly brain is like the computer. It's a mathematical a system of mathematical, governed by mathematical rules that can somehow be written down in mathematical form, logical form, whereas mind is supposed to be this thing that you feel is free. And so it's your thoughts, ideas, and feelings is what I consider mind to be, whereas...
So is there one big, gigantic mind, or is there a bunch of individual minds, or is there both?
Well, we are certainly we each have our own individual mind, and that's the basic idea of how we understand the world. You have your thoughts, ideas, and feelings. I have mine. And we feel that my thoughts, ideas, and feelings have a certain causal power over how I act, and your thoughts, ideas, and feelings have a certain causal power over how you will act. And so the whole point of quantum mechanics is it gives you a real logical understanding of how it is that something like my thoughts, ideas, and feelings can cause my body, physical body, to move in the way that I mentally intend. That's the big issue that we're talking about here. In classical mechanics, mind just does not play a role. The whole thing is mechanically determined. Whereas quantum mechanics allows you to understand in a very pretty clear way how it is that mental things, thoughts, ideas, and feelings, can influence and cause your body to behave in the way that you mentally intend.
Can you describe to us, because remember, we're not physicists, so we don't know all of the things that you know, but could you describe to us, how does science portray that to happen? Is it through waves and particles? Is it through light? What is it that allows us to move our arm up or to create our lives? Do we live in a hologram? There's a bunch of questions. Are we virtual? What are we?
Are you asking about mind?
I'm asking just however you want to interpret. Whatever you want, however you want to interpret it. I want to hear what you have to say.
Are you talking about the distinction between waves and or the relationship between waves and particles? Is that
how quantum mechanics allows for us to exist and create things? Is that it?
Well,
I don't want to be leading here, so I just want to give you room to say whatever you feel it is. Is it through particles and waves that quantum mechanics allows this to be?
It can be thought to derive from that, yes, because the quantum mechanics arose from a failure of classical mechanics to be able to understand and give a rational account of certain properties of what are called particles, that they seem to be both particles and waves. And now that's a contradiction in terms, because waves are things that spread out in space. You have a source of light, and the light flashes, and the light goes out in certain waves. You know that it goes out in waves because of certain so-called interference effects. If you're thinking of a wave in the ocean, then it has crests and troughs, and if you look at how it impacts upon the beach, you see that often if you have waves coming from one place and waves coming from another direction, that in some places the crests will add together and build up something that's twice as high, and in other places they will cancel and you will not get any up-down motion of the wave at all, of the surface of the water at all. So in that sense, you talk about waves because you have these interference effects. And light was initially thought to be wave-like because it exhibited all these interference effects. The so-called double-slit experiment, you had light coming through two different slits, and you found that there were these, when you looked at where the light fell upon a screen, it was back of these two slits, you found that some places there was the parts coming from the two different slits built up to something which energy-wise was, in fact, four times. It was twice what the sum of the two individual ones was. In other places, no energy was landing on the screen. screen. So physicists were very content with the idea that light was consisting of waves. Now, particles are something that don't spread out. They stay together in a very compact region. And so if you're thinking of particles, then the particle has to go through one slit or the other slit. Particles are much smaller than the size of these slits. And so you wouldn't expect any interference. Each individual photon or particle of light would go through one slit or the other, and you would not get an interference effect. Now, the problem was that although we saw these interference effects and hence knew or thought we knew that light was wave-like, once we looked in detail, we found that the amount of energy that was emitted from the original source all fell in one place on the screen. And so that picture seemed to say, well, it's emitted, all the energy is emitted in a certain quantum of a unit, and arrives at the screen at the same, with the same amount of energy that left the source. So you seem to have to think about it as a particle. And so that was the mystery that led to the creation of quantum theory. How do you understand this this conflict between the wave idea of what light is and the particle idea of what it is? So that seems like a mathematical, a puzzle, a logical puzzle. And in order to solve it, you had to create an entirely different idea of what the world was like. And although it seems like a long road, nonetheless, the conclusion that the quantum physicists arrived at involved bringing the human observer into the dynamical system. Now, it's a long path to see why it is that resolving the wave-particle duality, this conflict, is going to require you to bring human observers into the dynamical laws. And I don't have time to explain how that all came about, but that is the bottom line. So the wave-particle duality led essentially to the idea of that you had to introduce human conscious choices, free choices, into the dynamics in order to understand wave-particle duality. And that seems like a huge gap there between those two, but that's actually the way quantum mechanics developed, and it developed from the wave-particle duality, trying to resolve the wave-particle duality, and led to the idea that we need to introduce human conscious free choices into the dynamics. So I won't try to explain how you get from one thing to the other, but that's the bottom line.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that the human or the observer or the human or whatever it is, and that's a good question. Before I ask the question, is it anything with the mind? Is it dogs and cats and horses and cows, or is it just humans?
Who has conscious experiences? Well, certainly in quantum mechanics, we are mainly interested. The quantum theorists were scientists, and they were interested in explaining the results of well-defined experiments. And, you know, if you just kind of look at things randomly and don't try to make a systematic investigation, it's hard to draw conclusions. So the scientists were interested in doing well-controlled experiments, and
okay,
where the conditions are fixed by the scientists. So the primary intention here was to deal with the experiences of actually scientists, but of course scientists are not really different from other people. And,
oh, I don't know about that.
Well, in any case, The presumption was that all human beings at least have these same properties of being able to control their bodily actions in the same way that scientists are able to do it.
Okay.
And, I think most people think that dogs and horses and large animals can probably do the same thing, but it's a little more difficult to prove it.
Perhaps they're... And that brings up another thought. My next question was going to be this, but before you answered, I have something else I want to say now based on your answer just now. I was going to say, it sounds to me like you're saying that the observer's mind actually plays a role in the creativity of the individual's world. However,
exactly
I need to ask this other question before I ask that now. Assuming that your answer is going to be yes, I'd like for you to talk about, how do I say this? I believe, and I'm going to say this in my language, and maybe it'll make some sense to you. I believe that in order to create, consciously create, you use your awareness of who you are, whatever that means. You use conscious awareness to create a reality in consciousness. So, as I believe that different people have a different availability of ability based on their level of awareness of who they are. And I don't know if that makes any sense. So my question would be to you, is there gradients in conscious awareness that affects our ability to consciously create? Does that make sense? You know, some people can create very easily. They can think something and bam, it happens. Some people can think and think and think and think and think and it never happens because they don't get that they're attempting to create. They're just more caught up in physical reality than, you know, playing the game than they are manifesting their life. I don't know if that makes any sense or not. Does it make any sense at all?
Well, I think it talks about it. Depends upon what you are creating. Are you hearing me?
Yes. Yes, I hear you.
Okay. In other words, all normal human beings, without some sort of real physical problem, can create emotion that they, you know, I can. They can decide to raise their arm, or they can decide to move in this direction or that. That's somehow a creative act. You're deciding what you want to do and then doing it, and you may be mulling it over. You may have reasons to do it. And so you are creating a reality, and most human beings, normal human beings, certainly have the capacity to be creative in that sense. And now if you're talking about the ability to create a mathematical theory that... Or a physical theory, or to create a work of art, or a symphony. Different people, of course, have different capacities in those directions, which people are still debating, you know, to what extent are they genetically induced or induced by your early childhood. But certainly all people are not equally capable of producing a mathematical theorem or proving a mathematical theorem, but it's just I think a matter of, you know, different brains are. We all have brains that are constructed somewhat differently, and so different people have different capacities.
So, are you saying that it is the quality of your brain to process
well, certainly
the consciousness
your brain,
that flows
your brain,
through it?
The structure of your brain certainly has a great deal to do with it. And on the other hand, this idea of the psyche, of the mental entity that's somehow associated with your brain is according to quantum mechanics, it's not just the brain. The brain is being manipulated by the ego, by this mental entity that's associated with it. So you have the two sides, the mental side and the physical side, and according to quantum mechanics, these are closely related. Now, if you have a wonderful mental side, but for some reason the brain has become disabled or unable to function properly, it can be a great mind that's unable to produce because the brain is not adequate. And so it's a combination of the two. I mean, the mind and the brain have to work together, and what they're able to do depends upon both.
Okay. So back to the what the question was supposed to be, you're saying that individuals play a role in the creativity of their physical world. That's part A. Part B is, how does one increase the effectiveness of their ability to create or manipulate their world?
Well, the first thing is just, I'm supposed to affirm, ask me to affirm what I've said, that according to quantum mechanics, the mental aspect of a person, what von Neumann calls the ego or the abstract ego, is a essential element of the determination of what his body is going to do, and von Neumann spells out exactly how this works. In other words, how the mind it connects to the brain in such a way as to allow the mind, the intentions which are in the mind, to actually control the motions of the body. So the first thing is, yes, according to orthodox von Neumann quantum mechanics, which is what I am pursuing, the mind is able to influence the behavior of the body. Now, what was the second part of the question?
How do we enhance
that?
Yes.
Well, I think, and that's one important thing, I think that knowing this and knowing how it works and having an understanding of how it works already is helpful. If you are of the belief, if you have been raised or trained or gone to school and they told you, that quantum mechanics is the way things work, just a minute. If you're told this is the way the world works, it's all a machine, then your expectations and your how you behave is probably going to be very different from if you are told that your mind is in fact a source of creativity and has the capacity to make the world and make the body behave in the way that it intends, you are more likely to be creative just because you're told that you can be. And also, more subtly, the way quantum mechanics works, or seems to work, says that nature, and this is a kind of a recent development, but says that nature's choices, which according to quantum mechanics are purely random, are in fact not purely random, but are in fact influenced by the by the mind. So that means that your mind not only is able to control your body in the normal quantum mechanical way, but it also is able to influence nature in such a way as to bring to pass what you consciously value. So this is something that can, I think, be exploited if it's understood. If you understood how this works, how it is that you can not only influence your body in a semi-mechanical way, but that you can actually influence nature's entry. Let me explain that by saying, according to the quantum mechanical idea of how things work, the human being, the human observer, first has to pose a particular question. Is nature like this? Is the physical world like this? And then nature is supposed to come in, and according to the normal idea, nature answers that question yes or no, with a certain probability of yes and a certain probability of no. Recent experiments, however, seem to indicate that, in fact, nature's choice is also not random, but is in fact geared to favor favor consequences that are positively valued in the mentality of the questioner, of the observer. So if these experiments are correctly interpreted, it says that really we have some untapped, we human beings have some untapped powers to actually control nature in a way that even goes beyond what was understood before. And so if that is indeed true, and human beings and I think human beings, if it is true, can learn how to access it. Now, this is a little bit speculative, but if that's really the way it works, it would mean that by understanding the way nature works, you are actually able to empower yourself to cause nature to behave in the way that you would like, so to speak. And so this is rather a new development. But
I'd like to know about that. You said some recent experiments. I'd like to know about that. What are they?
Well, there are actually many experiments. There are a bunch of experiments by a Cornell psychologist, Daryl J. Bem.
What's the name? Sorry.
His name is Bem. He's a Cornell psychologist, and he did 9 different experiments, all of which were very different experiments, all of which are explained by this same capacity or the same property of nature to tend to favor more than the random rules would require positive values of the human agent who's acting. And but there are a whole lot of other experiments, eye dilation, heartbeat, skin conductance. All of these experiments have in common the quality that there seems to be the response of the human body to a probing action done by controlled by a random number generator. So it's kind of a random stimulation, and you expect that once the stimulation occurs, that the body will react to that stimulation, but the reaction has to be after the stimulation. And these are long experiments with many, thousands of instances. What is found in a vast number of experiments is that the response, the skin response, the eye dilation, the heart rate, various other physiological measurements respond before, up to a second or two before the stimulus was applied, and so facts that were just a couple of experiments, but there's now a huge number of these experiments. And I, you know, if, you know, if these experiments really are bona fide, and I'm not an experimentalist, so I'm, and some people doubt that the experiment, they say the experiments cannot be true, that this just violates the laws of physics, and hence it cannot be true. On the other hand, you know, the laws of physics sometimes are somewhat different than what you think they are, and that's would be a case.
So I have
the experiments have to be have to control the theory, not the prejudice.
So I have I want to go over one more area before we wind up. We've got about 10 or 11 minutes. I want you to spend a few minutes answering this question, and then I want you to talk about anything that you think is important that we've not had an opportunity to talk about, which I'm sure might be quite a bit, of course. But I want to ask you about paranormal activity, and here's my question. You don't know me really well, everything there is to know about me, but I have an ability. I can somehow tell people about pending disease in their body for years in the future. And I can give them, and I don't even have to see them. People call me from all over the world and just ask me to do this. And I can give them symptoms that they're having, subtle symptoms. I mean, very subtle symptoms. And then I can tell them what disease that is going to come way down the road. And inevitably, it's always right. I mean, you know, there are a few times when I'm not exactly right, but I'd say 9/10 of the time I'm always right. Is that, am I making that up in my head somehow, or does science support that somehow? Is that possible for people to have paranormal things? I mean, I know it is because I do it, but I'm wondering what science says.
Well, yeah, the particular thing you're talking about is part of a huge fund of experimental, so-called experimental evidence. I mean, people, there are so many reports of things like that, which are all termed paranormal, and under normal, under even the orthodox ideas of quantum mechanics, most of them are not allowed, even not only by classical mechanics, but also are not allowed even by normal orthodox quantum mechanics. And hence, even quantum physicists have been reluctant to believe that they could possibly be true. Now, two things. You know, throughout history, there have often been situations where all the best scientists believe something to be true, that this theory is true, and experimenters keep coming up with things that contradict it, and ultimately the evidence becomes so overwhelming that that the physicists have to change the theory in a way to accommodate it. And the bottom line is the things that you're talking about are these paranormal phenomena that even orthodox quantum mechanics forbids. But this thing I was just talking about, the BEM experiments and the, I would say, hundreds of other experiments like it, if they're really bona fide, do indicate that something has been missed in orthodox quantum mechanics, and that is the fact that the nature itself, nature comes into this theory in a very important global way, and that's another aspect of this theory. Even in orthodox quantum mechanics, nature's choice has a global reach. Nature's choice of what's going to happen here can depend on what is instantly going on in a far distant region. So even orthodox quantum mechanics has this kind of global, non-local, mysterious aspect, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance and could not believe was true, but nonetheless, that's how quantum mechanics in its present form works. Even in its present form, it does have these non-local effects, these global effects. Now, according to these newest experiments, if they're really true, the nature's entry is even more strange and unusual. It actually somehow seems to act in a way that is not random, but is basically, in some sense, controllable by the human agents. And if that is true, it would basically open the door to the sorts of things. It says, no, although orthodox quantum theory did not explain these things and was said they couldn't happen, this modified theory does allow these things to occur. So I would say that if these new developments pan out, it would allow the sort of thing that you're talking about to perhaps or probably be understandable in a way that physicists could understand, and that moreover human beings could, with proper training, be able to access. And so in order to exercise certain control over the physical world that orthodox contemporary quantum mechanics even
okay,
says
Henry,
is impossible.
You got 7 minutes, and I want you to talk about anything you want to talk about.
Well, I think I just pretty much tried to say the basic thing that I would like to talk about just now, but if these experiments that I'm talking about, which seem to indicate that we have beyond what orthodox quantum theory says is possible, if indeed the indications from these experiments are correct, then human beings properly can probably learn once they, you know, what you try to learn depends upon what you think is possible. And so if quantum theory gives you a way of understanding how these things work, people can, I think, learn to exploit them. And let me just give you some examples. There was classical mechanics, and before classical mechanics, everything was thought to be kind of irregular. Classical mechanics said, no, the world behaves in such a way, and that allowed human beings to exploit nature in such a way that was the foundation of the Industrial Revolution. The whole idea of machinery and everything could now be understood, and so people were able to exploit nature's properties in a way they had not been able to before they understood how nature was supposed to work. Well, that was one huge advance, the whole industrial age. Then quantum theory came along, and people thought things were impossible. Well, quantum theory basically provided the foundation for another huge advance into the computer age and all of the technologies involved computers were based on understanding things via quantum mechanics. Now, if this newest thing actually pans out, it will mean that there is another huge potentiality for understanding. understanding nature in a way that will allow us actually to do things that we were formerly unable to do. And if you can actually control nature in this way that is suggested by these experiments, it could open the door to another gigantic development in the capacity of human beings to bring to pass what they consciously value. And
I thought you had stopped. I was going to ask you a question. Do you believe that there is, and this is, personal question, I guess. Do you believe that there is a role for meditation or personal introspection involved here?
Well, I don't do meditation or...
Do you believe that that's an asset that people... How do people access, and we've only got like 2.5 minutes, how do people access and, I guess, charge this system so that it starts working more effectively?
It would seem that in order to access this, it depends on how you think about things and how you... it has to do with expectations and firm expectations. What you expect depends on what you believe, and if you believe that the world is a mechanical device and we're just robots, you are not inclined to expect anything to come from the way you're thinking about things. On the other hand, if you have a different idea of how nature is related to your thoughts and expectations, then you can think about things differently in a way that could actually change the way nature behaves. And that seems to be the what's involved here. And I don't want to say too much more than that because I'm not, because that's about all I know. And but
well, that's a good bit.
I have talked to people who say that they can bring things to pass by thinking about them in these ways, and these are people that I tend to think are sensible people. And so if these experiences are positive, it seems to open the door, at least, to the possibility that we really have untapped powers that are yet, that will become available once we're better acquainted with how they work and how to use them.
Well, Henry, we're at the end tonight, but thank you. I so appreciate what you do, and I so want to encourage people to take a look at your book, The Mind-Like Universe, Why the World Must Be Fundamentally Mind-Like and Not Matter-Like.
No, the name of the book is, the new book now is, has a different title, and it's only in the process, in the editorial process right now, but the title is... On the Nature of Things,
okay.
Human Presence in the World of Atoms. So the title again is On the Nature of Things, Human Presence in the World of Atoms. And so it currently is a matter, I'm not going to say whether what exactly when it's going to come out, but...
Well, thank you, Henry. You're the best, and I love your book.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Take care, and good night.
Good night.